Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia EV6. Inspire your senses. The fully electric EV6. Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And it's Joe at RT.ie, St. Stephen's Green in Dublin, one of the nicest public parks, one of the busiest, if not the single busiest public park in the country. Rebecca, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
It happened last Saturday afternoon to your 15-year-old daughter. What happened, Rebecca?
Yes, right. She was with three other friends in Stephen's Green, hanging out, as they say, and yeah. And then a group of girls came and attacked Hannah. My daughter.
Yeah.
And they recognized her from somewhere in social media, and they knew who she was, and so she was singled out, and they attacked her, and then nobody did anything. So it was. She was just being attacked and kicked and punched, and then they tried to get out. And when on the way out, when they were leaving the green, another bunch of girls came and attacked her again and threw her to the ground and kicked her, pulled her hair, threw beer at her, cans at her, and nobody did anything. And
She was the subject of two attacks by two different groups within 4 or 5 minutes.
I think the second group was called by the first group. So they called they knew each other. They called each other to come and join in. And
but why do you think they singled your daughter out?
I don't know. I think they recognized her from social media because, as you know, teenagers.
What do you mean they recognized her from social media? What does that mean?
That she probably was posting something on social media, and they recognized her, and they knew who she was, and decided to go for it. I don't know. I don't really have any. I don't know the reason for it. And I think it's very dangerous is that teenagers, they have all, you know, sometimes they have location activated into the likes of Snapchat and things like that, so other people can see where they are and what they're doing and who they're hanging out with. And if there's a group of people that don't like them, I don't know, that is easy to find.
But why would, do you mean they were following you or looking for your daughter?
No, they recognize her from the girl that attacked her first. She said, "I know you. I recognize you. You are that girl."
What girl?
Just the girl. the girl that she knew from somewhere she probably posted something on. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. And you say when they got your daughter, your 15-year-old daughter, to the ground, they kicked her.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's horrific.
Kicked and pulled her hair and kicked her in the face and the body. So she has bruises on her legs and on her stomach, on her arms, bruised knees, hands. Her face is all bruised. And she was they're just going back to school. Imagine her first day back at school.
And this was Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, Saturday afternoon.
Last, and she went back to school this week. Now, did anyone intervene?
No, that's what worried me, that nobody did anything. On the second time, she said that she could hear some lads saying, "Stop, girls, just stop this." But nobody called the police. And that's one question I asked. Why didn't your friends, I think they're all in shock. They because she was with three other girls and they were, I think they all paralyzed. They didn't know what to do. Nobody knew what to do. But in my head, it's like somebody watching this, an adult watching this, why wouldn't they call the police? Why wouldn't, you know?
And did the police come, do you know, Rebecca?
No. They went to the police station the next day, and they told what happened, and they said that, well, they will look on CCTV and see if they can find it, if they can see anything, if they recognize the group of girls. But probably not much can be done, as they are most likely minors.
They were so young. What age does your sister and her friends, and your daughter who's 15, what age does she think her assailants were?
I'd say similar age.
Same, 15, yeah.
between, I don't know.
Even if, regardless of the age, the Gardaí, did they take details of the crime
and say they'd
look at CCTV? Yeah. Or?
They know where it was because she did say exactly where it was and where it happened. So they, if they had CCTV activated on that place, they would be able to see.
Yeah.
And that's what. And then I rang when I came back, because I was away. I rang them, and they said, "Well, you can come back and, you know, give more details." And but my daughter is very scared, and she doesn't want to get involved in any of that. She's scared that the girls are going to come after her again.
I know.
So, and that is really scary, because if these people don't go anywhere, like they don't, you know, there's no punishment for them. And if you tell on them, like she said, they're gonna call me snitch that I told on them.
Yeah. And as you say, they follow social media and seem to recognise her from social media, whatever. And did they? Was your daughter the only one attacked?
Yes. Because they recognise her and the other three.
But why did they single her out?
I don't know. There was the first attack. There was one girl with her, and the second there was two girls, and then
there was a bigger gang.
Yeah.
Okay. How's your daughter now? Did she go to school?
She went to school, and we had to tell the principal what happened.
Of course, yeah.
And otherwise, you know, she's all bruised.
Okay.
And,
okay.
I think she's getting sympathy from the other girls and the other students in the school.
At 15 years of age, has anything like this happened before?
No, okay, never. I never, ever, ever expected. I was sick. Like when she told me it happened, I was in shock. Like I'm still. Like I think it's a nightmare that I'm just having a bad dream that this happened to my daughter, and she's just scared and doesn't know why it happened to her and why would somebody do that. And
okay. Well, I hope. But does she think that she may have posted something on social media that or said something on social media that would have made her?
That could be possible, but I don't know.
Okay. Well, I wish
because we don't know what they post on social media,
not at all. And the Gardaí, by the way, we've been on to the Gardaí, and they said they are investigating it.
That's what they said to me, that they had very little information. They didn't have the names, and
didn't have the names of the victims.
The names of the girls that did it.
Yeah,
like,
we don't
have the names of the girls.
Yeah, but that's why we have Gardaí called detectives.
Yeah.
That's their job, and they're very good at it, finding out who these people are.
Yeah.
Okay, Rebecca, I told her, have you given her any advice if it happens again, God forbid?
Yeah, so that is what we've been talking to her now. What would you do? And then she said, nothing. And I was like, no, you have to do something. You have to start screaming, scream for somebody else to call the police, go into a shop. Make sure that everybody around you
Do you know what time it was on Saturday afternoon?
It was in the afternoon, let's say 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. They'd like
you. You must have got a terrible fright as well, our parents.
Yeah.
Okay. Rebecca, I hope she makes a speedy recovery, and hope she's reminded that these people attack anybody. They weren't singling her out for whatever reason she thought they would. They don't need any reason. They're out of control at the minute. Rebecca, thanks indeed, and kind regards to your daughter. Okay, the Housing for All plan is being announced today. 300,000 new houses by the end of 2030. €4 billion spent every year. An end to homelessness by the end of the decade. 90,000 social housing. 36 affordable properties. 18,000 homes designated cost rentals, which would rent 25% below the market rate. The remaining 156,000 homes will be delivered. That's 52%. Will be delivered through the private market. Vacant properties and sites to be taxed. And apparently, if you have property above a shop, you can change it into residential without planning permission. And 500 homes per year upgraded through repair and leasing scheme for bringing vacant properties into use, which is where our caller comes in. And his name is John Galligan. John, good afternoon.
Hiya, Joe.
Tell us your story, please. And what
I sent you a photograph of my aunt's former residence. My aunt, God love her, Aunt Joan, died in her 90s in December last.
Okay.
And just for pig iron, I went down there last week to see how the new residents were getting on.
Because it's public housing, it's council housing.
She lived in a tiny one-bed apartment in Blackrock. And so I was half suspecting that I might find what I did find, and that was that the house is still boarded up. Now, they have put in a new kitchen. You can see that from outside. And they've done some work inside. I don't know how much. But the point that I would make is that she died on the 9th of December. The keys were handed back in January or early February. Mm-hmm. And this is now September.
Good point.
And that place is still empty. It's still boarded up, still empty.
And it's not. And you're not talking about a seven-bedroom house. You're talking about one-bedroom property.
This is a tiny one-bedroomed property. Tiny, tiny. I've sat in it many, many times with Joan. And it's just a tiny place.
And it'd be for people living on their own or whatever.
It would be for someone living on her own, yeah. And it suited her very well. It's a lovely little apartment.
Yeah.
I could refurbish that place on my own in 2 weeks. With the team of guys, it could be done in a week. If that was a private rented apartment, someone would have been living there 8 months ago. I've no doubt about that. And I think it's just an absolute disgrace. I was very taken by a contribution on another phone-in program last week by a lady who was bemoaning problems she was having with the school transport system.
Yeah.
And what struck me was she called directly at the staff in the Department of Transport, and she said, do your job. Do your job. You are paid enough. Don't give me COVID. Don't give me lack of resources. Do your job. And, you know, I applied that to this situation, and I thought, someone is not doing their job. When that is taking 9 months to refurbish a tiny little apartment, and in the meantime, the people who would be in that apartment could well be living in boxes. And that's unacceptable. I mean, I'm a travel agent, Joe, as you may know, in Sandyford. And if I don't do my job, somebody doesn't get on their flight. Yeah, in this case, if somebody in the council is not doing their job, somebody could be living in a box. And I find that disgusting. And as a taxpayer, I think it is time that we started looking for value for money. And at the same time, Joe, it's worth saying that the council are falling over themselves to rent new apartments from funds on ridiculous terms for 25-year leases and to get people in housing.
And
places like this are empty.
And $1 billion every year is spent on housing assistance payments and rent supplements, basically. $1 billion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, Joe, many of your listeners will be able to identify for you similar properties that are boarded up. The council comes in, they strip everything out of that's existing in that place. I was talking to my uncle today, and he was the brother of Joan, and he was gutted because there was a beautiful plant. I can't remember, I'm not a gardener, so I can't remember the name of it, but it was a big bush that he said took 30 years to grow. The council ripped that out, and he's very upset about that because it was a beautiful plant, a small garden attached to the apartment. And
we have a statement in from the council, John. Are you ready? Brace yourself. What did you say? COVID is no excuse. Did you mention that? Every effort is made to ensure the vacant properties are re-tenanted at the earliest possible date. However, excuse me, various factors can affect the length of time a dwelling remains vacant. Over the past year, the added complications that have arisen during the COVID-19 pandemic have resulted in longer re-let times for properties.
I'm sorry, Joe. I run a travel agency. We've been through the worst times with COVID. Yeah. My staff have worked on the equivalent of the dole for the last 18 months, and we have worked every day, and none of my clients have been let down. Everyone got looked after to their satisfaction. Yeah. I don't buy a COVID defence. I think there's too many people in Ireland hiding behind that to excuse poor service. The construction industry was allowed to work through a lot of this. And the irony is, Joan would love this because Joan and I used to sit in her apartment, and she would tell me about when the painters were coming to paint the council houses in the neighbourhood. She would be sitting at the window, and she'd see them going up in the morning, and she'd be laughing, saying, And about an hour and a half later, they're coming down for their tea break. And 45 minutes later, they're going back up to do some more work. And an hour and a half later, they're coming back for their lunch break. And, you know, she'd have a great laugh at this lark. But there is a very serious side to it, Joe. And there's a lot of people. I mean, do very little work with Vincent de Paul. Well, I wish I could do a lot more. But I know the other side of it, Joe. And there are people who are homeless, who need that apartment.
And a lot of people who are homeless, I know there's mixed, but a lot of people who are homeless just want a one-bedroom place to live
Absolutely.
In. A roof
Absolutely.
Over their head, yeah.
Yeah, and the point I was making is crisis, what crisis? There is no housing crisis within the council or within, to my mind, the entire government, political, civil service. There doesn't seem to be a perception that this is a crisis.
So in other words, if somebody isn't saying, come on, lads and lassies or whatever, let's get that. There's a one bed. One makes a difference. One does make a difference.
One
to start
difference,
with,
yeah.
Let's get that property back to somebody who needs it.
But, Joe, you
ASAP.
Can multiply it by... I can identify three more in Dalkey that are boarded up for the last year. I mean, this is... I don't see the logic in this. And it's no good... Minister McGrath coming out with a brand new plan. Sorry, not McGrath, the housing minister today coming out with a new newfangled plan to solve the housing crisis. If the people he's supposed to have implementing his plans are not doing it, and they're not, there's no excuse why a tiny one bedroom apartment like that, COVID or not, is still empty 9 months later.
Okay, John Galligan, well done for all your work, and thanks for making that point. And your aunt sounds like she was
Joan was a dough. She's sadly missed. She had 50, she's 56 nephews, nieces, grandnephews, and grandnieces, and she could name off. She was 93. She could name off the birthday of each one of those.
Brilliant,
yeah, sir.
Brilliant. That's one a week. That's one a week.
She was a great woman.
On average. We'd say Dara Breen will be on every program today talking about the new housing plan. But as you say, there's
a housing plan isn't worth a curse unless you implement it, Joe.
Yeah. Okay. Willie, stay there, John, if you wish, because Willie White wants to join in. He's on the planning task force for Dublin Chamber. Go ahead, Willie.
Hi, Joe. Well, I just particularly wanted to say something about this idea of living above the shop.
Yeah.
It's not a new idea. If you have a look online, it's been talked about for about 20 years at least, and it hasn't delivered any living above the shop. Part of the problem is that most shops have only got one door. So you either use the door for the shop or use the door for a home. So it might be much more interesting to actually think about turning shops into homes instead, particularly with, you know, changes in retail and there being vacant properties. But the living above the shop is...
Housing Minister Dara O'Brien is also expected to announce. Dara O'Brien is expected to announce planning exemption to develop homes above shop and business premises, as well as tax on vacant property and sites. You're saying it doesn't make a difference.
If I walk into Dublin City Centre along Capel Street, which has been pedestrianised now and looks lovely, all of these shops with vacant floors have only one door. So unless the minister can also introduce another door or another way of entering the building, I don't see how you can reconcile its use for retail or whatever and residents as well.
And would that be difficult to put? Well, first of all, you take up shop frontage if you put in another door.
You do.
Which is so valuable.
They're quite narrow.
They are, yes.
These old, particularly city centre premises, are older buildings, and it's these ones that are usually talked about when people point to vacant floors.
But it's not simple as saying.
I looked up at one stage. I think the earliest reference I could find was 1999. So in 22 years, living above the shop has not been delivered. It sounds good, but it's more complicated than that.
You see, you're talking about sounds good. I remember when the government, it was the Labour were in power, when they banned outright bed sits, and that sounded like every political party agreed with it. Because bedsits were seen as grotty and grimy, and we had a slew of calls day after day for about a week saying, please don't ban bedsits. I love my little bedsit. And what's happened now? All of those bedsits went out of commission. And that's just one simple thing where it sounded great in the opposite direction. It sounded, it's the end of the grotty bedsit. But they didn't listen to people saying, hang on, I'd like living in a bedsit. I'd like having shared. The whole thing was, you shouldn't have to share a bathroom or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's what happened. They banned the bedsits, believe it or not.
Way back in the day, and I don't have particularly fond memories, but other people do.
Yeah, I take your point, but to ban them outright is bizarre. Okay, John Galligan, thanks indeed. Willie White, go to Mina Mocker. Joe at rt.ie, 51551's the text number.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
We've been contacted by Micheál McKeown. Micheál is 79. He has an 80-year-old sister called Patricia. Micheál, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Joe.
When is the last time you saw your sister Patricia?
Never saw her, Joe. Haven't met her.
When will you meet her for the first time?
On the 10th, Friday week.
Tomorrow week.
I think that's, yeah.
That's incredible. So how did you link up again?
It all started with me doing a DNA test last February, 12 months.
Okay.
And my daughter did one at roughly the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my results back, and it just, the usual thing, it just showed I had some connections. Mostly my family, the McKeowns, are South Armagh, North Louth, and Tarna, that area in Galway, where my mother came from. And my daughter's DNA, which was done with a different company, showed a very, very close connection, a family connection, to some lady in England that we never knew about. We didn't know who this was. So it was suggested that I would send my DNA results to my daughter's company and they would merge them.
Okay.
They have a database that they can merge these things. When this happened, about 3 weeks afterwards, I'd completely forgotten about it. And I was sitting at my computer one day just doing some work or other. And the next thing was I saw this email coming in and I started scrolling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this thing which gave some reading, which in the units that of relationship, it showed something like about 400 or 400 and something centimorgans, which is the units of how they rate these things. Relationship, and up came the word sibling.
Wow.
And I almost collapsed.
Yeah.
Because I had a sister who died, very unfortunately, 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
When I saw this sibling, I couldn't believe it. For a few seconds, I actually kind of said, what does sibling mean? You know, and I checked and I looked at it and I checked then with the DNA results and it meant that we had a common mother and father.
Wow.
That immediately, Joe, started. I told my family about it, that my daughters and my sons. They started doing some research. I then started doing some research. And for the first time, I found that my mother and father were married in Coolock, not in the village of Drumiskin, where she was teaching and where my father came from.
And have you spoken to your sister?
Oh, many times.
Oh, great.
Many times.
Great,
we've struck up a great relationship. We've had video calls and everything.
Oh, and magic. And who was driving this, if you follow me? Was she driving it?
She was driving it as much as, well, we knew nothing about it. She spent her life looking for her parents.
Wow.
Or her family.
Oh, my God.
She gave up the hunt maybe 10, 15 years ago. She just kept hitting cul-de-sacs.
Mm.
Even though she had private detectives and everything searching for her family. Now, her background is that she was adopted by a Protestant family in Belfast from a mother and baby home.
Okay.
She had a rather unfortunate upbringing with them. She didn't like them very much and they treated her terribly.
Okay.
She left and went into a home who reared her until she was 16, and she got her 11 plus exam, etc. She was a member of the Northern Ireland Youth Orchestra. Very, very...
Wow, well done.
She's a very good singer. I've heard her singing. And she was a viola player, and she actually played with James Galway. She's still a friend of his.
Fantastic.
Then, at the age of 18, or something shortly afterwards, she emigrated to England.
Mm.
And she met a man. She eventually got married and settled down. She went into banking, and she became right up at the top level of banking. She became personal secretary to one of the top bank managers and worked at that all her life and still spent all her time looking for her parent family.
to no avail until recently. Until now, she's found. Now, what? You share the same mother and father. You're full siblings.
Oh, we are full siblings.
So
yeah.
how did Patricia end up being adopted?
Well, it appears that my mother was a governess to a local family in Drumiskin,
yeah,
a very wealthy family.
Drumiskin is where?
County Loud.
County Loud, okay.
It's a coastal village, almost a coastal village. Fairly well known. It's about midway between Dundalk and Drogheda, something like that. My father was a young carpenter at the time from a farming family, fairly progressive farmers. And they started dating. And my mother became pregnant. And, of course, then they decided to get married. And they weren't allowed to get married in the village. They had to go to Coolock. Now, my belief is it was because of a rather tyrannical parish priest at the time.
So they weren't allowed to get married in the village of Drumiskin, where they were living. Well, your mother was working in. Okay, so they went to is that Coolock in Dublin?
Coolock in Dublin, for some strange reason. And I never knew this, and none of my family knew this. And it was never spoken about.
So they get married and Patricia comes along?
Yeah.
And why?
What happened, Joe, was even more complex than that, a more complicated thing. My mother went into a mother and baby home in Belfast 3 months prior to Patricia being born. Now, we've no reason why she did that. I know no reason why she would.
Because she was
that.
Married at the time.
She was married, and shortly after she was married, she went off to Belfast and admit herself into a mother and baby home.
Okay.
And we have the records of that. We found the records.
But was she still, and both of them, were they still living and working in Drumiskin?
Well,
if they were getting from some quarters in the Drumiskin, if they were getting admonition, they might have felt, anyway.
They moved out of the village, that's for sure. I know actually where they moved to, about 10 miles away.
Okay.
And my father rented a house at that stage.
So your mother goes to Belfast, a mother and baby home, and Patricia, even though her parents are married, Patricia's put up for adoption.
She is.
Okay. Now, we'll come back to that in a sec. Did your parents, Micheál, ever tell you about Patricia?
Never, Joe. Oh. Never a word, and it was never suspected.
And is Patricia the eldest in the family?
She is the eldest.
Ah, God. And what was it like for her? I know we have her number, but it's not. It's there's a problem at the minute getting through to it, but because she's in the UK. But what was it like for Patricia to discover that her parents were married to each other, obviously, and went on to have other many siblings in the family, many children in the family, after Patricia?
There was another girl, then me, and then a younger brother.
Okay, that she has. The parents were married and then had three children.
Yeah.
And your parents never told any of them, maybe?
Never a word. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about the history of my mother.
Okay.
She got ill 4 or 5 years after that. She got TB.
Okay.
And she had to go to a sanatorium. She lost a lung. Yeah. Had a couple of very serious operations. Okay. Went to a sanatorium and spent 9 years in it. So there was very little contact between
her
family and her. She was in Piemont and my father was forced to visit her all up and down. And it was just shortly after the war.
Yeah.
He didn't have a car. He'd sold his car before the war.
So did you know your mother when you were growing up?
Joe, she used to write to me in Irish because she was a Gaelgori.
Okay.
And I used to get the local teacher to translate them.
Yeah.
And I'd write back in Irish after she... Yeah, that's the only way we communicated.
And what would she say in the letters?
Oh, she was very friendly. She always wanted to know how we were getting on. And
did she ever come home?
She came home for a year before she died. Now,
just because the younger people don't remember... even hearing when they were growing up. I heard about it when I was growing up, about the great TB epidemic in the 1940s.
At the time, yeah.
But did you, was there, how long would go before you would see your mother? How long is the longest? Do you follow me? She was in hospital for 9 years.
We were brought on two or three trips to see her. We got out at the gates of Piedmont, yeah, and she would come to the balcony of her ward, which was about 50 yards away, and wave to us. And that happened twice.
In the 9 years?
Yeah. And once myself and my brother and my father got in to see her, shortly before she came home, I have a photograph of it. And it was the only time we actually met her face-to-face in 9 years. Because
God,
the ruling
God,
at the time was a regulation of the hospitals that nobody under 14 was allowed near the place.
Yes, I know.
It was taboo.
So, as well as suffering from the awful illness of TB, which is dealt with now and has been for a long, long time, you have social isolation. She's standing on that balcony. I know it's awful for you, Michal, and your brother and sister and your dad. But she's standing on that balcony.
Yeah, just waving at us.
Sure, a prisoner would have more rights.
That's quite true, yeah. Yeah.
And then when she came home, what age were you when your mother came home after 9 years in the TB sanatorium?
Well, I was just starting secondary school when she came home. And prior to that, I was living with my father in a rather large farmhouse, and my brother was still living with an aunt, and my sister was living in Termefecken with another aunt.
Yeah.
When my mother came home, we all came together then for the first time as a family, and as far as we were concerned, we had Mammy home.
Yeah, which is fantastic.
Yeah, but we didn't know, we subsequently discovered that she got out of hospital when she realised she was terminal.
We forget the horrors that.
So, like, after a year, 14 months or something after she got out, she died. No, she was mobile. She could get around and she visited people, and my father took her here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
But not a word in all that period was spoken about this sister.
What age was your mother when she passed, Michal?
Oh, she was only 40-something. She died in 1960.
Of TB?
Yeah.
TB. And have you told all this to Patricia, your sister, that
you're due to
meet next week for the first time?
Yes,
face-to-face.
One of the first things I did was I got the family tree out. And I can date my family. We can trace our family back to 1812 in a direct line. And even before that, I got the family tree out and I put her name on it and sent her a copy.
Oh, well
and
done.
She was overawed with the whole thing.
And have you discovered, like, she's a sister that you've now found. She's 80.
Yeah,
you're 79,
she's 81 now, yeah.
81, and you now meet for the first time next
That's
week.
Right.
Where is that meeting, that historic meeting?
In my house.
in Drunk? In
Blackrock. I'm in Blackrock, County Louth.
In Blackrock, County Louth, okay.
Yeah.
And would she stay for a few days? Or?
Oh, she's staying for 3 weeks, I think. Maybe longer.
Isn't that brilliant?
And her son is coming with her.
Ah,
magic. The only blood relation that she knew she had up to last year was her son.
God.
Her world was that small.
And does she must look like you, or one of your sisters, or...
She does. She has red hair. My sister has red hair.
Yeah.
And some of my mother's family in the west of Ireland have red hair.
Yeah.
And my grandfather was known as the Red McKeown.
The Red McKeown, okay.
And she's now the Red McKeown.
Okay. And what, you've told her the story of your mother and that horrific story of
she
TB.
She knows all about it, yes.
And what did you tell her about your dad?
Her dad. Yeah, her dad. And I told her as much as I could about him. Loads of photographs and photograph of him playing his fiddle and everything, you know. Yeah. That's obviously where her music talent comes from.
He played the fiddle, and she, even though she obviously have no memory, she was given up for adoption when she was very young, she ended up playing
a viola.
Yeah.
So it's a remarkable story.
It's an incredible story. And did COVID, I presume COVID stopped you meeting,
COVID
didn't it?
Stopped it. Just at the point of discovering her, COVID clamped down. So we couldn't travel. She couldn't travel.
I think people forget the horror of of TB, and that's why Dr. Noel Brown is in the pantheon of Irish heroes,
because
he was Minister of Health and he went out.
My mother knew Noel Brown.
Did she?
Because he was a good Gaelgorey and he visited her a lot. And yeah, she knew him. She knew the whole thing about him. The discovery then of streptomycin, which cleared the whole thing.
In one fell swoop, almost, but still the stories and the lingering stories are there. They're receding now with time, which is a pity, because it's such.
Well, I'm the historian as well as retired draftsman, and I'm writing all of this down.
Well done, Mike.
I want my family to know about it.
Yeah. And is there any? Does Patricia or yourselves have regrets about, the what ifs? Why didn't we meet up 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years?
Absolutely not. This is a remarkable thing. Patricia hasn't a bad word to even say about our mother and father or question them or anything.
Yeah.
She knows it was the time that was in it.
Yeah.
And the church was very strict.
Yeah.
My mother's parents were probably strict as well about it.
You see, I remember a story here on Liveline. And we were doing it, we'd done adoption a lot and people finding their family. But I remember one of the most poignant ones was, and they were very, very poignant, was a man who went in search of his parents. And he was still 18, 19, 20 when he found his parents. And he found that they were married. So he drove up to where they lived in some estate in Dublin. And he drove around past the house. And there in the garden of the house, playing or whatever, was his mother and father and three or four other children. But he was as much a part of that family as they were. And that's what that made him incredibly sad, that he was given up, so to speak. And then his parents married and they never came back for him.
Yeah.
That was the tears.
That's very sad.
Isn't it?
But it's much the same poignancy as my family now.
Yeah, I just wonder, did your parents ever say to you, your mother is away for 9 years, how could they?
Yeah, they were very close.
Yeah, but maybe if TB hadn't happened, they might have gone back and looked for their daughter.
Indeed, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Because the last thing, if you think about it, your dad is trying, well, your dad and your extended family, your mother's extended family are trying to rear three young children.
Yeah.
That's going on. Your mother is in a sanatorium in Dublin with TB. A very, very, very limited contact allowed. And I'm sure that your father is saying, sure, why would I go after and look for Patricia? Hopefully she's in a much better situation than we find ourselves in at the minute.
Yeah.
In fairness to the man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Michal, you should be so proud of your work and your sister and your family and your daughter and his, Patricia's son as well.
Yeah.
That'll be a very emotional meeting tomorrow week.
It is. It is indeed. I'm slightly afraid of it and at the same time really happy about it.
Yeah, but you've already had a lot of... Thank God. It's pity about, it's horrific about COVID. Again, another pandemic.
One of the great things is we've had video calls
a
couple of times every week. I know the inside of her house and she knows mine.
Okay.
You know, our gardens and everything.
Did you discover you have any tastes or habits in common?
I notice her idiosyncrasies are exactly like my deceased sister. Very, very much.
Are they? Okay.
Yeah, she answers questions the same, and she looks at you the same, and you know.
But she has, would she have a completely different accent?
Oh, she's a completely different accent. She's a limey, you know, as far as I'm concerned, she's a limey. I'm going to get some Dromiskinite shoved into her when she's here.
And again, describe that. One, you describe very well the feeling when you were told you have a full sibling somewhere, but describe the feeling when you spoke to Patricia for the first time.
It was tearful.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. Even when I called my family and my brother's family, because my brother's in hospital, he's very ill.
Yeah.
And he has vascular dementia, and he's unaware of all of this.
Yeah.
And he's a younger brother to me. But I, when I was explaining it all to my brother's family, I was in tears. And Patricia told me she was in tears herself, but she was talking to her son and saying, I found out who my family is.
For her.
And she felt she also had an affiliation with music and Irishness and everything like this.
Okay. And did she have a feeling that, well, she knew she was adopted, obviously, so she knew she came from somewhere that wasn't the family that she was reared into.
Oh, no, very unfortunate as well, which complicated the whole thing, just muddied the waters unbelievably. My mother gave a false name when she was going into the mother and baby home. And that appeared on Patricia's.
The record.
Yeah, that appears on Patricia's birth certificate.
Yeah.
So she thought her surname was McKean.
Yeah.
Not McKeown. So this is why she kept hitting dead ends when she tried to find her parents.
Yeah. I interviewed Val Dunican. Do you remember Val Dunican, the singer?
I do indeed.
I interviewed him once. Gorgeous man. Beautiful man. Again, he's dead a while. He very, very massive star in the 60s, 70s and early 80s in the UK. But I remember that he talked about TB and his father lived in a shed at the bottom of the garden, and they never saw him because he had TB.
They
used to leave his meals outside the door of the shed, and he'd come out, and that was the horror of TB, the infectious nature of it.
Yeah.
Isn't it incredible?
Well, when I was at primary school, I was reared in the village of Loud, where an aunt lived.
Okay.
And when I was there was TB testing done on all the children. And I was what was known as a reactor. And it was discovered that I, at some stage in my infancy, had TB, which I probably got from my mother. But I had fought it, and I had the antibiotics bodies for it.
Yeah.
And at the time that happened, about one third of the children in the school were also reactors. They were also children of somebody with TB.
Yeah.
That's how common it was. That was in the late 40s, early 50s.
It was a scourge.
It was an absolute scourge.
And I
remember my mother, in the year that she was home, she spoke a lot about her time in the hospital. And I remember her telling me about Dr. Noel Brown coming in to see her. And he was using my mother to improve his Irish, and because she was a very well learned, that she was, she actually spoke a couple of various dialects of Irish, and she knew Dr. Noel Brown because of that, you know. And, she just knew she was a very lucky woman to have lived as long as she did, even though she lived away from us.
And how did she? What was her overall feeling about the 9 years she was in hospital without seeing?
She never spoke about it.
Yeah.
She never spoke about it at all. It was as if she had got out of jail, and it's as if she didn't want to know about her past life.
Yeah.
And we didn't question much at all about her past life.
And I know there's a fantastic, Noel Brown himself wrote an autobiography which was extraordinarily well received, with that really iconic
copy of that,
iconic cover by Bobby Balla. And he was, I know our Uachtaráin Hare and Michael D. Higgins was a great friend of Noel Brown and a great admirer of Noel Brown as well. And people, but I think sometimes people can forget how much a difference one man can make. He was also a medic, and I'm trying to remember now his life story, but I think he was raised by a family who kind of took him in and looked after him, and he became a medic, and yeah. he was evangelical about getting rid of TB.
He came head to head with the Catholic Church over Barry's thing.
Subsequently, over the mother and baby home. The mother and baby scheme, which was, if reading about for anyone under 50, 60, reading about why the government was going to fall and why Noel Brown had to fall on his sword over the mother and baby scheme, it's almost laughable. It's horrific.
It is.
The government had decided that they were going to improve the health care for mothers and their babies. And the Catholic Church, in the guise of Archbishop, I'm prefacing it now, but it's much more nuanced than this. The Catholic Church, in the guise of Archbishop John Charles McQuaid, said no, this was the care of children must be left in the hands of the parents, not in the hands of the state. Laughable stuff in this day.
Yeah, My mother often spoke about that.
Michal, there's an incredible reaction to you telling your story. Please, the Mother and Child Scheme, it was called. Please meet as soon as possible. And I know that
we
is.
Will.
Yeah, and please.
We will.
And what did you say earlier? She's coming for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do? You'll feed her, you'll talk to her, you'll play music.
Yeah. We'll have a song together and play a bit of music. And I'll give her a few Dromiskinite statements.
What would they be?
It's how to talk in Dromiskin, you know. Hey there.
Go ahead, yeah. Give me a few Dromiskin. Hi there.
Well, how are you?
How are you?
Yeah. How are you?
And Michal, what did you, so far, you've done an incredible amount. What did you do in your working life?
I was started off as a draftsman. I served my time as a pattern maker in an engineering works, the foundry, which is a highly skilled job.
Right.
And left that, went to England for a year and a half, then got a job in PJ Cards as a draftsman. They were building their new factory. So I went in there as a senior draftsman, rather liaison between Carroll's and the architects.
Yeah, great.
And I worked as the factory had been built. And then I got a position as plant engineer, looking after all the plants, air conditioning, all of that.
Making the cigarettes.
Yes, I did. Thankfully, all I had to do was the cigarettes.
The major, and
yeah.
And tell me, you said you went to England. Was there any time when you've been reminiscing with Patricia prior to your first meeting next week? Is there any time in the 80 years both of you have been on God's earth? Is there any time your paths might have crossed, and obviously you wouldn't know each other? Was there any time when you were in England that you were?
No, I don't think so. I was in Hull. I was in Hull College of Technology and working for a firm as well. And that's where I was until I was so lucky to get the job in PJ Carroll's.
Yeah.
So I immediately came back and took up my position and then got married within that year.
Okay. Well, I hope I know the reunion will go well. It's the prenuptial at this stage.
I have six children and they're all going to come down in a bundle, you know.
In a bundle, okay. Don't swamp her too much now, Michal.
No. feed it to her gently.
Feed it to her gently, okay.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Joe. Thank you. I'm glad you understand it, you know.
And God bless your family. And God bless your poor... What was your mother's first name?
Sheila.
God bless Sheila and what
Sheila
she went through.
Sheila Nigurum. She was a very good Shannon singer.
Oh, Shannon's okay.
Shannon, she was actually first cousin of Sirikini Gurum, famous Shannon singer.
Okay. And did Patricia ever say that she got close? Because she said to me one stage, private detectives, that she got close to finding your first.
She did. The private detective came as far as Blackrock in County Louth, where I now live, but was chasing down a McKeown family who still live here, but not our family. They got on to the wrong family.
So they were Patricia got very, very close to finding her family.
Indeed. Very, very close. Had that private detective searched for the other McCones in the neighbourhood, she would have found us. Okay. Because an amazing thing, on the bottom of Patricia's birth certificate, McKean is stroked out with a pen and McCone written.
Okay.
So this is how she began to think, my name's not McKean. My mother must have changed her mind and wrote McCone, or somebody found out.
Yeah.
Now, Patricia's taken her birth certificate with her, and I want to see where this is written in.
I'll
recognise my mother's handwriting.
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioned that Patricia inherited an interest in Irish, even though she was reared in Belfast and then went to England after she was adopted, and her musical ability from your dad,
obviously,
who played
my father,
fiddle,
yeah.
And then she played the viola. What about, can she sing? Your mother was a great singer. Can Patricia sing?
Yes, Patricia's a gorgeous singer. She sings in the local choir in Tamworth, where she lives.
Fantastic.
And she's done a few CDs.
Okay. A remarkable story. Good health. Michal, many, many more years of good health. And I'm sorry to hear your brother's unwell. But good health to you and Patricia and your extended family.
That's great.
You can enjoy these years together now. You were lost.
And
you're found after 80 years.
Now we're found. You know, it's going to be a tearful reunion, but...
Tears of joy.
Brilliant.
Tears of joy.
It will be brilliant,
Michal, good to meet you, Mahogut.
And
it's a fantastically uplifting story in these awful times. And thank you so much. And all our love to you and your family. And when I say all our love, I'm looking at the listeners' comments here from people saying that is the most uplifting and joyous. Outpourings of joy and great fervour have greeted this story, Michal. Best wishes for the next historic 7 days leading up to September the 10th.
It'll be a great meeting. Yep.
Okay. Michal, slán go fóill. We'll talk again. Good mark.
Slán.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Jerry, back to the government plan. One of the announcements, let's talk practicality rather than aspirational. One of the announcements is that apparently that you can compare to the accommodation above a shop or a shop to accommodation without getting planning permission. Jerry, to housing without getting... Jerry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Tell us what are you doing this? You're converting a shop.
Yeah, I converted a shop that I couldn't rent because of different circumstances, high rates and all that, and had it rented just before COVID and then pulled out of it. So I converted it to a one-bed apartment because it's only 45 square metres.
Okay.
And planning cost me roughly 2,000, which, you know, is a standard fee. And then I got hit with a development contribution of 6,700 and odd euros.
For what?
For services, like roads, water, sewage.
But the shop was already on a road.
The shop is there over 50 years.
The shop already had water, I presume, in some shape.
It has water, has everything is there. Everything is there.
And the shop already had a loo, had it?
It had.
At the back for staff or whatever. And you were saying when you went, this is the big government, one part of their bells and whistles thing today, they're saying you can convert the shop to accommodation, but you're saying the council, between planning and development fees, looked for €8,000.
Yeah, 2,000 for the planning. But like some of that went to the engineer for doing new drawings and all that, and I don't know what the fee to the council was.
And is it because the shop, by its very nature, shops by their nature tend to be in central areas?
This is in the middle of a housing estate. Like everything, the housing estate is 50, 60 years old. Like everything. I don't have a problem paying it, but it's just a one bed apartment.
What are you paying for?
Well, I suppose I'm paying for our services that was in 50 years ago.
I presume the shop is paying rates.
Is it, yeah, it's paying rates for the last 50 years, yeah. And actually, the rates were quite high. That's why I couldn't rent it. That's why I couldn't rent it. Like, I think the rates were 2,500 for 45 square metres.
Stay with us. Stay with us, Jerry. That's okay. Jaw drop. John is in Dunleary, back to boarded up properties owned by the council. You've been out and you counted within 5 minutes. You counted the many idle council properties, John.
No less than seven, Joe. And that have been sitting empty there for months on end, and it's nothing new. This has been going on long before COVID ever arrived. It's just slow turnaround of council properties. Everybody knows about it, I'm sure, in every residential area.
Yeah, but if the councils can, on one hand, say through from money from the taxpayer that it would give a billion. A billion euro every year in housing assistance, rent supplements to private house owners to take in people who are in need of housing. 1 billion per year. Surely they can take a fraction of that and hire outside contractors to do up houses or to whatever has to be done.
That's exactly my point, Joe. You know, they say they don't have the maintenance crews nowadays because...
Hire them. Yeah. There's a housing crisis.
Absolutely. In a time of crisis, it would be something that should be done straight away to get people off the streets and into these properties and not have them sitting idle for months. And some of them even close to a year, Joe. I've walked around on walks throughout the last year during the pandemic and I've seen these places boarded up. They're just left there. And even when they are allocated, it can then even take months after that again for them actually to get around to putting people into them. Like, it's just ridiculous, you know what I mean? And this is in every area around. It's not just confined to this area. I'm sure everybody living in different parts of this city and suburban areas would have the same story, that there's council properties boarded up everywhere.
Crisis.
You know, I wonder, could the Minister for Housing maybe get onto the Dunleary Rathdown County Council and get a list of how many of these properties are actually sitting there waiting to be...
But you know what he'll get back? He'll get a list back, all right, like we did today, a list of excuses.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Stay there, John. Olive Power. Olive, good afternoon. Hello. County Louth.
Hello, Joe. So how are you doing?
How are you? You knew there was a housing crisis, so if something happened. Your husband...
In 2017, my husband inherited a substantial farm over in... a very picturesque area of the country. I won't say where now.
Okay.
But the house itself, we had no need for the house. We own our own property, so we didn't need this house. Beautiful farmhouse sitting on an acre of a land of a garden and a view of the sea and all the rest of it within 7 miles of a large enough town.
Okay.
It would house a mother and father and maybe up to 8 children. The house was so substantial.
So spacious, okay.
Now, it needed some work to it because my brother-in-law, God rest him, was a bachelor.
Okay.
And my husband said to me, what did I think we should do with the house? And I said, well, it was left to you. You decide what you want to do with it. And whatever you decide, I'm happy to go along with that. So... as I said, we didn't have need for the house, so we offered it to the county council.
Well done. Well, that's an incredible... Right. That's an incredible gesture, Olive.
We didn't want anything for it. Yeah. It was to house a needy family. And the council turned round and said, no, not interested. Anyway, it's too far out from the bigger town. That was the response he got.
So you were giving the council this valuable house.
We were giving the house free gratis, plus the acre of land it was sitting on, which was the garden all around the house. There was an orchard, vegetable patch, you name it.
And was this recently, Olive?
This is in 2017.
In the house, the greatest housing crisis that's befallen the country since the tenements of the 1920s.
2017. This is 2017.
And they said, the council said no.
The council said too far out from the main town. Now, there is a town 7 miles away from where the house is sitting on the main road into this town.
But we now live...
supermarket in it.
Yeah, but we now live in a different world of technology and broadband, and people love living in the country. They can work. But the council just said no. They didn't
not interested. Too far out of the main town.
So what did you do?
My husband turned round and he got on to Pat in the CEO of the Father McVary Trust.
Oh, yeah, Pat Lynch, isn't it? Yeah,
his name, yeah. And we gifted the house to Pat and they were absolutely thrilled to get it.
That's incredible. And they've taken it?
They have taken it and they're working on it. They have plans for it. They're going to turn it in, as far as I'm aware, into a sort of a place for respite for families that need a break from whatever.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
But talking, your last caller was talking about a house that's been boarded up, etc. Yeah. I'm living in Black Rock in County Louth here, out of Dundalk. And there's some fine houses around here and they're all, I've seen a number of them in the village here, boarded up. I'm living here 4 years now, and they're boarded up.
By the way, Olive, when you contacted the council and you said to them, I'd like to give you a house and an acre of land, did they say this happens all the time or this has never happened before? Or did they say anything?
No, they were quite abrupt. He emailed them and then he phoned them to find out why the offer was turned down, and the response they gave him was, because it was too far out of the main town. Can I say where I'm talking about?
Yes. No, don't. Not for the time being. No.
All right. Okay.
We'll tease it out later. And Olive, did the council come back and say, actually, if you gave us the property, could we sell it and put the money into our housing budget?
They were given the house. They were being given the house, and they could have done what they wanted with the house.
Okay.
The same way that Father McVary Trust are doing what they're doing with it.
In other words, you said you can take the house and there's no catches. Take it,
my late brother-in-law wanted, in what his dying wish was the week he was dying, and he actually, God rest him, scribbled out on little notes of paper on him ill and dying. He said that because the country, parts of the country are so depopulated, he wanted fresh blood into the area. And he said to my husband, do your best to get a family in there where the place can be populated again.
Incredible. What a great man.
And that is what my husband followed his brother's wishes to the last.
What was his first name, the uncle that died?
My late brother-in-law, James.
James. Well, may James rest in peace. He was that is an incredible gesture.
He was an absolute gentleman.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Horrible death.
Yeah, sorry to hear that. He was lingering, was he, for...
Well, he was diagnosed with brain cancer in July 2017, and he died on the 9th of November.
Okay.
The 9th of November.
God rest him. He's obviously part of a great family, and you were glad to know him as well and lucky to know him.
Oh, indeed. He was an absolute gentleman.
Okay, well, may James rest in peace. Olive Parker, thanks a million,
not
Olive.
All,
incredible
all,
story. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And the government plan that's been announced today, the figures will overwhelm you. 4 billion every year on housing. Many hit you with some numbers now. 300,000 new homes between now and 2030. An end of homelessness by the end of the decade. 4 billion a year. 90,000 social housing. 36,000 affordable properties. 18,000 homes cost rental, 25% below the market rate. 156,000 homes built by private, and plans to allow people to change property from a shop to accommodation without planning permission. But you hear the ins and outs, might be without planning permission, but you still get hit with development fees of, and in that case there, 6,000 for a place that already has a building that already has water and sewage going into it, sewage coming out. Declan, good afternoon.
Oh, hello, Joe. Hiya.
Cork City, what do you witness?
Well, I'm about 15 minutes walk from the centre of town, and I'm living in a council development. There's about a dozen houses here, and one of them, they were built in 1990.
Okay.
One of them has been empty for at least the last 3 years, maybe more, fine house property. When I walk into town, I pass at least four that have been empty for the last couple of years, some even longer. But I've seen a couple they probably built about 20 years ago. They got trees growing out of the roofs. I pass other ones that have been built about a year and a half ago. They're still empty. Fine new apartment complexes, council-owned, and they're still empty.
You're saying there's the one with the tree growing through the roof?
Yeah.
Is that a council property?
Yeah.
And it's been empty so long?
Yeah.
Was it a house?
Yeah,
it's accommodation.
Yeah.
It's been left empty so long by the council. A tree has grown and made its way through the slates and through the rafters.
Yeah. You know the buddleia that take roots very easily all over the place. Yeah, there's buddleia grown out of the roots.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me go.
And another thing, Joe, which is the light of this, which I think should be pointed out, you probably know this, one of the crucial things with maintaining properties is gutters.
Yeah.
And the council passed on the responsibility for cleaning the gutters to the tenants a few years ago, which means a lot of, it's expensive to hire people.
Whereas if the council did it, they had machinery and height for hire or whatever.
Exactly.
It could be done within minutes, yeah.
Exactly. And the council owned the properties, so the council properties, you know, but yeah, they're laying the
gutter leads to damp. Catherine, in Chapel Lizard in West Dublin, what do you witness, Catherine?
Hi, Joe. There's two council-owned properties in the estate where I live, and one of them has been vacant for a year, the other one for the past 3 months. And when the management company contacted the council, they got a very vague response as to when they will be reallocated. And it just beggars belief that there's so many homeless families out there. The other thing I would like to point out is that when the council do allocate these properties to tenants, there's no proper vetting. So they just put anybody in and hope for the best. Like, if we were to get a family-orientated, homeless family, you know, instead of problem tenants, then, you know, that they could integrate into the area.
And when you say the management company, who's the management committee? And where?
Well, I'd like not to mention that.
Residents.
It's a private estate, you know. So.
Okay. But the council own two apartments.
Yes, they own two apartments in there. But there's no forward thinking or no cooperation between the council and the management committee or the residents to say, you know.
But the management committee are saying, come on, get a family in there.
Yes, like there's vague responses. The other thing I'd like to recommend is that Dara O'Brien would, you know, put a watchdog in place for all the councils to, you know, like an ombudsperson to check.
There is such a person. It's called Dara O'Brien and his department.
Yeah, but they're obviously not doing their job.
It's a big department. Lots of people working in. Okay, Catherine Gurumahaga. That's Catherine Chapel is in West Dublin. 51551.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
A number of people ringing us about death certs. Joanne, your father died age 70, quite young actually.
Yeah, he was.
February this year. And you had a post-mortem, I presume?
We did, yes, because he died very suddenly, so we had to go for a post-mortem. Now, they were saying in the hospital, oh, COVID. That seems to be blamed. A lot seems to be blamed on that lately, but it was the middle of July by the time we got a death cert.
And did they say what was the delay?
Yeah, again, they were blaming COVID, big delays with post-mortems in hospitals because of COVID. And then when eventually the coroner got back and said, oh yeah, the death cert is available, I got onto the death cert deaths, births, deaths, marriages in Galway. And they were saying, oh, well, the coroner hadn't sent in the post-mortem results, and sometimes they have a tendency to take their time sending in results, unfortunately. That slows things up as well.
Okay, okay. And the death cert means a lot in terms of moving things on, so to speak.
It does, with wills legally, and banks, and because, you know, I can't do anything until we can get that, you know, unfortunately.
Anyway, may rest in peace your father,
Martin. You.
Thanks indeed, Joanne. Fergus Weeney. Thank you. Fergus Weeney produced. Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia e-Niro. Going electric? Stop wondering and start driving. The Kia e-Niro, with a range up to 455 kilometres.
1850 715 815. Stays open until 3:15 p.m. Or email joe@rte.ie.